G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White, good morning to you.
Not really. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm feeling a bit like you.
I'm feeling a bit like you at the moment because, I worked out last night that I haven't left the house since Thursday.
At all?
It's now Wednesday.
Oh, you need kids that work at Macca's.
Oh, that's so actually, that's not, pick them up. Yeah, that's right. I've walked to pick up James from Kinder.
Oh, there you go. That's good.
And Jemima from Kinder. But I haven't actually got in my vehicle and gone anywhere since last Thursday.
Right. There you go. Yeah. So you're getting serious about this?
Well, not really. Well, I'm trying to, but... It's just what's happening, isn't it? You got to stay at home, so you stay at home.
Well, that's the
rule. We can work from home, and that's what happens. So, I thought, you know what? I thought of you. Because that's what you did last time. You almost didn't leave the house for about 3 weeks there at one point, didn't you?
Yeah, about 8 weeks, I think it might have been. I was inside. Didn't actually go outside at all. Although I did pick up a lot of dog poo. No, I picked up a lot of dog poo. A lot of dog poo, and I did walk the dogs. Now, I walked dogs most days in the period of the last 4 months,
yeah.
5 months.
But I'm a dog walker. Not getting in the vehicle, except to get bread for lunch.
Yeah, I'm a bread specialist. I go and get a little coffee and a bread, and a loaf of bread. That's my job. I'm the official bread gatherer for the family, and I quite like that couple of minutes. It's about 14 minutes, the round trip.
Yeah.
Getting there, buying the bread, getting the coffee, coming back home is about 14 minutes I've worked out. Shouldn't be too much around that.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just a bit nervous isn't quite the right word. Anxious, concerned, I'm not sure. Just about where we sit with things at the moment. The races off at Warwick Farm today is a bit of an issue.
Yes.
Obviously, what's happening in Sydney at the moment, maybe they're being overcautious. Maybe they're genuinely concerned. Probably a bit of both with what's going on in Sydney at the moment. We've got AFL teams fundamentally now trying to rush out of Sydney before it's too late. And we've just got to try and find states that don't have COVID-19 to keep the season going. We saw Russell Westbrook in the NBA world test positive to COVID-19 yesterday.
We did.
You wonder whether the NBA is going to get back in early August like they thought. I just feel like we're in this bit of holding pattern at the moment. We're not really sure what it's going to look like in a few weeks' time.
Well, New South Wales is interesting from the Australian sporting scene perspective because Anastasia Palaszczuk, Queensland Premier, has decided that they're locking out certain parts of New South Wales. This Casula pub...
Yes.
Was anyone in Australia not there on this night? That apparently
seems real. Well, I think it's more the fact... Well, firstly, it does appear like there were 6,000 people in there. But it was over a period of about 10 days that they're wanting to know whether people frequented this pub. It's because it's seen as a pub that's... It's a bit of a... and I stand to be corrected here, but... A pub that's used for a lot of truck drivers that drive from Melbourne to Sydney. It's a bit of a stop-off spot for dinner or whatever. Yeah, a little bit like that. So that's where the initial concern came that maybe the virus had come from Victoria, from someone that had no idea he or she had it and had dinner there, and the rest is history sort of thing. And it just shows how quickly it can spread. And obviously, and again, I'm not an expert on all of this, obviously, but one of the issues now they're saying is that maybe we never had a wave. This isn't a second wave. This might actually be Australia's first wave.
I don't say that.
That's the concern. So we will see.
Well,
we will see.
Off the SMS, early doors, and send them through 0416905052. Hi, lads. Can't believe what's happening over there. We could be back to so-called normal next Friday, and Tassie says the first SMS of the mornings. It's not helpful. It's not helping us at the moment. But we wish you the best of luck down there in Tassie. Great to have our Tassie listeners with us on RSN 927. Tassie might be, I was talking to someone last night, Tassie might be an important part of the AFL continuing too through certain phases of the year as well. So we might see a bit of footy in Tassie. So the person I was talking to last night suggested.
Well, that's right. I think all the irony half of some of the things that we had chats about through the first lockdown about, you know, NRL Island or, you know, hubs and, you know, I think we all remember that the idea of hubs was howled down by a lot of people at the time. That there's no way it can happen and all these sorts of things. And then we're now in a situation where the hubs are the only things that are going to keep the AFL going. The irony and all of that. So, and NRL, you know, they're looking at potentially either moving everyone to New South Wales or everyone to Queensland to stay in one state. So, yeah, as I said, look, I don't want to sort of put a downer on the show, and I feel like I already have. But we are in a little bit of a. I feel like we're in this holding pattern where we're just waiting and watching and seeing what's going to develop over the next week or so to see where we're at with a number of things in the world, in life, not just in sport.
Did you know that it's 114 days today since we started the work from home arrangements here at the Breakfast Club? 114 days.
Yes. That's and we even got to a point where you worked at work twice in a week.
Yeah, I know. That was only a couple of weeks ago.
It seems like a lifetime ago.
It was only a couple of weeks ago. Well, the good news is we're all in this together, Whitey, so everyone's helping each other in the States. No one's making a mockery of the Vics. Although the former Victorian Premiers have decided that that's garbage and the Kick of It campaign is in full swing. Full swing, the Kick of Vics.
Yeah. Nah, interesting times. Now, I want to ask you a question straight off the top.
Right.
Well, it's not straight off the top because we're already started.
Earlier proceedings.
Is Dylan Sheil unlucky?
Now, for those playing at home, the 2-week suspension handed by the MRO held up last night at the tribunal. Ben Long's case was a 3-week sanction handed down by the tribunal last night. It was the minimum that he could get. Was he unlucky? Grand scheme of things, yes. With clearly the current intent on taking head high hits out of the game, no. So I think there was a clear statement made by the tribunal last night on the back of what the MRO had decided on. The MRO, Chris O, had decided on Monday that they were going to be really strong on head high hits, particularly when. You choose to bump your libel for the outcome if you get that wrongs, and you are entitled to bump, by the way. But I think there's been clearly a statement from the MRO/tribunal/headquarters that if you get that wrong these days and you cause a bit of damage, we're going to put you out for a bit because we don't want that in the game. So I think a bit stiff, yes, but I think this will be the new norm. Being a bit stiff in these matters, head high contact, will be the new norm.
So, if Chris O had the evidence from North Melbourne that Curtis Taylor didn't have a facial fracture,
which they had, and didn't have
concussion, the tribunal had it, but Chris O didn't have it when it was initially classified. Do you think Chris O would have classified the impact as medium and not as high?
No, this is my point. I think there's now an appetite to elevate those instances to the higher possible category, rounding up, if you like, as opposed to rounding down.
That's right. Now, we spoke about that with Jimmy on Monday. That's fine. But you can understand why fans get frustrated when rules are changed in season. Now, whether that is the interpretation of holding the ball or whether it is a directive to the MRO, potentially, that we've got to be harsher on these things because we don't like what we're seeing.
Yep.
I can understand how fans get frustrated by what we see in round three versus what we see in round six. It frustrates people.
Yeah, but in fairness, we haven't seen many of those situations. Like on the weekend, we had four of those type of hits, but two really big ones, which we haven't seen. I haven't seen one of those sort of bumps for ages. I can't remember the last time I saw situations where players have gone past the ball and hit bodies that hard and hit heads that hard that they've caused that level of damage. So, and Dylan's wasn't necessarily the level of damage, but the action was
the
executed
intent.
Poorly. Intent, well, no, but the action was executed poorly. The intent was never to hurt.
But the intent was to go past the ball and get Curtis Taylor out of the way.
Yeah. And you've got to get that right. As soon as you go past the ball, you've got to get that right. And making a play at the same time at the ball. So I understand why there would be a level of frustration, but in fact, I'd love to get the temperature of the audience. So 0416 90 50 52. Are you comfortable with, or give us a call, 1300 652 927, are you comfortable with a harsher interpretation of head high hits, considering what's going on in the game in terms of concussion and all the research that's coming out with that? And it is clearly the biggest issue the game faces, concussion. So I'm not surprised we've got to this point. I am surprised it takes until something like this to make that point. Like, this should have been announced at the start of the season. If you choose to bump your, hit him in the head, we're going to round up. We're going to elevate the possibility for damage, and that's going to hurt you on the way out the MRO and the tribunal. That's what I think should have happened, but it didn't happen.
Yeah. It's a little bit like in racing when there has to be an announcement of a change of tactics in the riding of a horse.
Yeah.
That if that sort of information is made public before the round starts, it doesn't just help the players, but it helps the fans in understanding that if that incident happens, oh gosh, he's going to be in trouble here because they're clamping down on this. I think that's more acceptable than it just... See, to me, the Dylan Shear one was a fairly clear-cut medium impact situation, because Curtis clearly got hit high. He stayed down on the ground for a little bit, then went off. He wasn't concussed. He doesn't have a facial fracture. To me, that was medium impact based on what we've seen in the past.
Yep,
and we've always talked about it being an outcome-based situation as opposed to an action-based situation. Some players get lucky and some players get unlucky.
Well, that's one of the pillars. It's not an outcome-based situation. It's just one of the pillars.
No, it just feels that that's the way it would have been handled in the past. And I was just very surprised going into the tribunal that based on the evidence that North Melbourne was able to present about Curtis Taylor, that it wouldn't have been downgraded. And Chris O, as I said, didn't know that at the time. And I wonder whether it would have been different had he had that information. Anyway, he's got 2 weeks, and I don't think Essendon's going to be able to take it any further. They tried hard. They got Mark Williams involved and all sorts of things.
Explain to me that. Explain to me the Choco Williams situation.
Well, it's a character reference.
How's that going to help?
Well, I don't think it would have helped at all. But have his future father-in-law, or maybe he's already the father-in-law, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure they're married.
To come in and say that he's a great ball player and all these sorts of things, and he's, you know, which he is all of that. But I don't know how that was going to help.
Character references, full stop. I don't understand. You get your sanction right, and then in the preamble, you tell him you've played 1,572 games and you haven't been reported in 27 years. But that's all at the start. You don't need it at the end saying, but hang on a second, he's a really cool guy. We all get that. We understand that. But I'm not sure why you bother with that stuff. Winkers is in Castlemaine. Good morning, Winkers.
How are you?
Going well. How are you?
Yeah, pretty well. Shear just a bit unlucky. He ran past the ball and with a lot of bumps. That was always going to happen. He's 2 weeks today, so I think he's lucky with that. But I just wanted to comment about Mick Malthouse. We've got him coming up this morning.
We do.
Sorry?
We do.
I just wanted to say, he coined the phrase, you know, it's not a sprint race, it's a marathon. Well, this year, I think it's a bit of an ultra-marathon. It's going to be survival of the fittest and test of the toughest for the longest. What do you reckon, guys?
Well, might be a bit of a Cliff Young ultra-marathon type setup, running from Sydney to Melbourne in gumboots.
If they start wearing gumboots, I'm out. I think you raise a good point. I think it's an enormous challenge for anyone to survive this because of the length of time between games from here on in, from what we're led to believe, the player requirements through all that. The depth of your list is going to be critical. How you manage your players in game is going to be interesting as well in the last 6 or so weeks, I reckon. It's a fascinating year. It is absolutely a fascinating year for the way that teams manage their lists and manage the games. And it's very, very different. We all understand that. But I think it's that does make that level of intrigue does make it a very exciting season.
Yeah, and I think Winkers, a lot of the players that we've spoken to have said the same thing about this year. It's a year where the mentally strong will survive and will succeed. And whether that's an acceptance of where they're based in a hub situation or just the concentration to be able to play well consistently where you're playing games on a lot more regular basis, dealing with bad luck, dealing with unfortunate situations, that's going to be the team that copes with that half is the team that's going to win.
Yep.
And I think Essendon's a really, you know, it's a good case with the Bombers at the moment because they're clearly going well. They're 4-1. But now they've got to deal with not having Dylan Sheil. Then they don't have their captain. And then there's news yesterday that Joe Danaher has had a bit of a setback. He's nicked his calf and is 2 more weeks away from potentially being deemed as being fully fit. They're the little setbacks that Essendon's got to be able to overcome and be able to deal with and still play well. And, you know, in the past, they haven't dealt with those sorts of things too well. So it'll be interesting to see how far they've actually come from last year.
Oh, Joe. Goodness me. Just continues for Joe. Off this mess, 36.5 degrees, says the baker. What's that mean? Has he just had his temperature taken?
Maybe that's what it is in his bakery at the moment, down in Hampton.
That's very hot. It's very hot. Send me through why you've sent that, baker. And if you've got a vanilla slice, just send it to my house if you don't mind. Half, how do you know what his intent was? Have you spoken to him? That's regards to Dylan Sheil. No, not the intent of his mind, but intent to be in that contest. You're entitled to be in that contest and lay a bump. That wasn't an off-the-ball, intentional action to cause harm and to cause a reportable offence, probably better said. And that's what I'm talking about when I say intent. It's careless or intentional. They're the two categories. So that's pretty straightforward. And if you're suggesting that it was an effort to commit a reportable offence, I think anyone who's watched football would suggest that that's folly. So thank you for the SMS. I personally love
it's two parts of that. It's two parts of that half. It's the whole thing about an intentional action is to be deemed intentional, you have to prove the player intended to bump in the head. So that's why you're going to very rarely get a situation where you're going to get a player on intentional bumping to the head.
If anything in play is difficult to cause, be referenced as intentional, because that's the word intentional is not the dictionary definition of intentional is not how the MRP, the tribunal, uses.
That's right. You have to prove that they intentionally tried to bump or hit someone in the head. Now, what we're talking about with the intent is that Dylan intended to bump as opposed to intended to just get the ball.
Yeah.
Or tackle. He intended to bump, and that's what we're talking about. Now, he intended to bump. He got it wrong. That's why it's careless. That's why it's not intentional. And then it's all about impact.
Thank you for the SMS. I personally love the bump. It's so unique to our game. But if they are unsure, why not just outlaw the bump altogether so it can be separated from what is allowed and what isn't allowed? They need to stop changing the rules. Well, the rules are the same. It's just a more stricter interpretation, just like the holding the ball one that we're seeing in terms of the general play at the moment as well. At least they announced that, and we had a bit of a heads up on that.
Yeah, and I still think, Half, and I've said this before, and I know we've discussed it as well, I still feel there is a, not necessarily in the Curtis Taylor situation, but there still needs to be some greater responsibility taken by players to look after themselves out on the field. This poking your head out into a contest rather than actually trying to protect yourself and turn your body, which is what we're all learnt to do as kids, I think is a real issue in the game where players are putting their heads where they shouldn't. And often it's to try and draw free kicks. Yep. And other times it's just that they don't have the right technique. I wonder whether the slide rule has had something to do with players not wanting to lower themselves into a contest because they're worried about giving away a free kick for making contact below the knees. I think there's a number of things that need to be investigated a little bit more significantly around why we have players not protecting themselves going into a contest, because I do think that that is contributing to certain incidents.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of my great bugbears. I'm absolutely concerned for the safety of players in those situations where they put themselves in vulnerable positions when they don't need to. I don't think they apply to the ones that we saw on the weekend, it must be said. But there's certainly plenty of them through games and in recent years where players have put their heads directly in the hole for no good reason when their bodies could have been there or their bum could have been there, just to look for free kicks to advance their cause for the team, which is not the way to be playing the game, because someone will end up in a chair and that will be the worst day we've ever met in footy. Our RSN Legends series continues today. We've had some of the biggest names in Australian sports, certainly from the world of Australian football. And today's guest is no exception to that. On this day, he made his debut. In 1972, July 15, 1972, he made his debut for the St Kilda Football Club. Now, some people would never know he played for St Kilda, but he did. 53 games for the Saints, 121 for the Tigers, and then decided that coaching was a good career opportunity and did that 718 times to be the record holder in Australian football. It is great to have Mick Malthouse with us on our Legend Series this morning on RSN 927. Good morning, Mick.
Good morning on this locked-in day. Another day.
Have you been out for your walk yet, Mick?
I'm actually, believe it or not, phone call from Merv Cohn to say, come on, let's get going. So once we're finished here, we'll be hitting the track. Merv's had a couple of knee replacements, so he's on the about the 2 to 2.5 hour time frame. So we'll get some hours in and get out in some fresh air.
Now, your time in football is so extensive. We could talk for 15 weeks with you, but we're going to condense this. We'll let you get to Merv at some stage this morning. We're going to condense this. And on this day, 1972, Mick, you played your first game for the Saints. What do you remember about this day?
That's a very good question. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing?
Not a thing. Not a thing. Well, I can tell you what I do know about it. I got a game. I was in the seconds. Travis Pays pulled out. So I got my first game that way. I woke up on the Sunday morning and found out that I'd played a senior game. I actually got knocked out.
Oh,
right. Last time I got knocked, apparently, these are all apparently. I got cleaned up in the first couple of minutes, played until half time. It was wet at the Western Oval at the time.
Yep.
And coach Gene said to me, or said to the team, that you guys better change your boots. You're slipping and sliding all over the place, which I did. Apparently, sitting next to Jimmy O'Day, and I said, I think I'll change my boots. And he's gone, okay. And then I said to him, I think I'll change my boots. He's gone, right. I better call a doctor over. So I realised I had a little bit of concussion. So I don't remember anything about my first game.
Oh, that's a disappointment, Mick. A massive build-up. You get your first crack and you don't remember a piece of it.
Well, it's quite unique, I suppose. It's something I didn't want it to happen too often because, it's when you play a good game or a reasonable game, you want to remember it. So it's the bad ones you want to forget.
No, 100% correct. Although you wouldn't have played many bad ones, I wouldn't have thought. But coming from North Ballarat, I mean, being in the big time in the VFL, what was it like?
Well, what was it like? Well, it was, as a kid growing up, your ambition really. I mean, I wanted to play the top level football, but the top level to me was early days was North Ballarat.
Yeah.
I didn't have, I was a good footballer. I wasn't a great footballer, and but I barracked for the Pies, and up and down the, if it was too wet outside, you'd be kicking the socks around inside the aisle of it was Peter McKenna or it was Carl Dittrich or it was someone, and you just admired them from a distance. The Saints were a pretty good side. They played off in 1971 against the Hawks. Probably should have won that game. So they were a reasonable side. And when I got invited down as a part of the zone in those days, I played my three practice matches and then was told, listen, you better go back to Ballarat and enjoy your footy because you're not quite going to make it. So... You look around you and you see Cowboy Neil and Dittrich and Smith and Davis and Lawrence and you think they're spot on. I mean, what am I doing here? So it was a real privilege to actually play in those practice matches.
Yeah.
Because Alan Jones was a coach, and so when you're a kid from Ballarat, you look down and you think, well, Melbourne's the pinnacle of all football in those days, and So anyway, I went back to Ballarat, played a few games, and come back that same year. So I was a bit lucky, sliding doors effect in many respects. But so the ambition as a kid was just to play, you know, as high as you can get. But certainly didn't think I was capable of playing league football.
And you played 53 games in the end at St Kilda, but you also played in finals. As you said, you were part of a pretty strong team. But then you got told to go. Did you get told to go to Richmond, or was it your choice to go to Richmond?
It's funny days. My naivety was I got a couple of phone calls from clubs, and I said to my wife, Nanette, aren't they nice, you know, ringing up to see how I'm going. And, you know. Anyway, I can't remember the actual circumstances, but on June 28, I think it was, or June 27, I got a phone call to say, look, Sam, we'd like you to come in and sign up. You've been cleared to Richmond. And I thought,
right.
Oh, okay. So I went and signed up, and that night, you work, and I was working for a semi-government place, so I caught the train down to Moran, where I lived, and went and got my boots, and as I was walking out, I bumped into the reserve coach, and he said, what are you doing? Not training. And I said, well, I've just been cleared to Richmond. And he said, oh, I didn't know that. So, strange things. 2 days, one day later, actually, it was a Tuesday, we flew out to Adelaide and played a game of footy. I sat next to Tommy Hatey, and then we had a game there. That was that sort of strange series that you had in those days. Then I trained again on the Thursday, and then I played my first game for Richmond. I'd say it would be close to July 1, July 2, or something like that anyway. But whatever it was, you're cleared pretty quickly. When I went to Richmond, there were four or five other players that had been at other clubs, Ian Scrimshaw at Hawthorn, I think Dizzy Lynch from Geelong, or Footscray, Robinson from Carlton, and Graham Gaunt from Melbourne. So we all turned up on that in those last couple of days before clearances closed. So it was really strange. It was a strange sort of system. In fact, it was a good system, but it was strange.
So the 19th of June, you played your last game for the Saints in 76, and the 3rd of July, Mick, you're pretty spot on. You played your first game for the Tigers in round 14 in mid-year. Fascinating.
Yeah, that's the way it worked in those days.
And one of those games, Mick, that you played for Richmond, you went on to play 121 games there, of course, was the 1980 Premiership win. I'm hoping that you remember more about that than you remember about your first game.
Oh, I certainly remember it. Yeah, it was quite extraordinary. I guess by that stage, I was 27 years of age. There was only five or six players that would have been older than me, and all of those players, or basically all those players, had played in multiple premierships. And it was one of those years where we started to make good. We started to believe in ourselves. Tony Jewell was the coach. We started to dominate sides. And it was one of those years when you think, no, this is not getting away from me. So I think the senior players put real pressure on some of the kids coming through. You know, I'm talking kids like Mark Lee in the ruck, Michael Roach, Will Ford, Dale Waitman as a rover. And we got them on side as far as thinking, look, it's not going to happen forever, so let's make the most of it. So it was a fantastic year. Some, you know, great friends. And, I mean, your friendship seems to grow with premierships. And, you know, you bumped into Michael Roach walking around the MCG the other night, actually. And, you know, it's funny, you just look back on little bits and pieces that took place. I'll never forget looking up the ground and seeing him jump over the pack and take that massive mark against Hawthorn, which is in folklore, of course. And these are things that I suppose are synonymous with teams that you go on and you win a premiership. Not saying you don't make friends in other times, but I think there's a bond, real bond, and you guys would all know about that.
Mick, when did you know...
Yeah, that's right. We all do. Oh, sorry, Adam, go.
No, sorry, Cheryl. I was just going to say, Mick, when did you know that you were going to be a coach? Because obviously you got into it quite young, but when you were playing towards the end of your career, did you know that that's what you wanted to do? And were you already starting to formulate how you were going to go about it? How did that all unfold for you?
Yeah, well, funny enough, you're right. Midway through my 20s, you don't have to look too far around and see players retiring 28, 29 those days. A few go into their 30s. And again, there wasn't... There was nothing in my mind that said I'm going to coach VFL football or AFL football. It was more the case of I'd like to stay in the game when I finish, whether I go back to Ballarat or whatever. Pretty set in Melbourne, mind you. We had two girls by this stage, and thinking, you know, where do you coach? And where, when you finish, what happens? So when it did come about, I had a really bad injury in 1979, before the 1980 finals, actually. I had a reconstructed knee and ankle. And I thought that might have been the finish. So I started making some preliminary plans then to explore coaching, whether it be in the bush or, as I say, back to Ballarat or VFA or something. As it turned out, at the end of 83, when in my last year, I approached Wangaratta, or Wangaratta approached me, and I had their vinyl, their club song, so that was quite interesting. And then I had an opportunity to put in for Central Districts, which I missed out on. Cowboy Neil got the Central Districts job. And then a couple of months later in January, the great Shane O'Sullivan gave me a call and said, would you be interested in coaching Footscray, which was out of the blue. But I've got to say, when I say out of the blue, he spoke to me the previous year, but not in terms of coaching their senior side, just good friendship. So that's how it came about. But in my wildest dreams, I never thought I'd be coaching a VFL club at 30. But, you know, these things happen and you grab hold of it and you hang on.
Mick, you've had a great amount of success, both, you know, as we mentioned in that 1980 game and throughout your coaching career. I want to ask you something you mentioned. It was about that confidence and that belief that you started to build in 1980 and that really want to get it done and make the most of an opportunity. Is there something that you feel like has worked that's been consistent across those years that you were able to be really successful across those teams? Because sometimes you're in something and you think, oh, we just need a spark. And when you're living it and when the spark is there, it's like you want to bottle it. Is there something that you feel like has been a real key to those successes?
Well, I think first and foremost, you've got to have trust. If you don't have trust in one another, you've got nothing. So once you build that trust and you start to believe in the direction you're going and you've got enough players on board or enough people on board, you need a lot of people. If you go back over the last 20 years, and you could probably go back to this, but let's work on 20 years. No team has won a premiership. It's been a club. And what by that I'm saying, you've got to have the board absolutely on side, and they're going to be travelling in the same direction or the direction you're travelling what they want. Then you've got to have administration that will support you totally. And then from there, it's your role is to make sure you get those players travelling. They've got different personalities, but believing in what you've said and where we're going. So it is all built on trust. Now, the moment any of that breaks down, the board aren't necessarily on song with you, or someone in the administration is not on song, no matter how good your side is, I've seen it happen, it doesn't work. So it's everything I stand for is to build on that loyalty and trust that you can get that in your players and they have it in you. The moment that breaks down, everything breaks down.
Liz Ellis, who's Australia's second greatest ever netballer after you, Sherelle, we know that. And she's now heading up an independent review of the game itself. Who else would you rather have online for that? Liz, good morning.
Oh, look, I nearly hung up twice then.
What was the first time?
Well, the first time is you trying to do Aaron Neville, and the second time you're telling me that, okay, I have to agree, Sherelle's probably Australia's best netballer. I'm happy to play second fiddle to Shirazzle Dazzle.
Shirazzle Dazzle. Now, it's no disgrace to be second to the great Sherelle McMahon, Liz. You're pretty close. It's a pretty close battle.
Oh, thanks.
Now, tell me, what's this new role you've got with Netball Australia with this independent review? What's the concept and what are you trying to get out of this review?
Essentially, it's a review into the state of the game. And the idea is that with the COVID crisis happening and lots of sports are hemorrhaging and are hurting, not only the elite level, and we've heard a lot about the professional leagues, but a lot of state organisations for many sports really rely on the income from people registering to play sports. And all over the country, we're seeing local competitions be cancelled or postponed. Mm-hmm. That is hurting state bodies. The professional end is hurting. So it's a good time to actually take stock of the game and figure out how we can do it better. So we're going to look at everything, whether netball is delivering the best product to its customers and its consumers. Now, I suspect that it is. I think netball's probably, I'm going to beat our drum. I think netball delivers the best competitions at local level in the world, without any exception. You know, you can turn to a netball court on a Saturday morning, and in about an 8-hour period, 5,000 people are put through their paces on the netball court. Umpires turn up, games start on time, everyone has scoreboards. So I think that core product is really good. But who are we missing? Are we missing boys' competitions? Are we missing men's competitions? Do we need to be more flexible in how we deliver it? And we're looking at that all the way through to the elite end. Who is best primed to run the game at that professional level? So it's a real whole of sport review.
I couldn't agree more with netball being the most efficient sport on the planet. My daughter plays, and she's 16, Liz, and at the Ashburton Centre there, and there's about 12 courts or whatever, and from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night, there are games every minute of that day, and it's military precision. It's remarkable the number of people that are obviously involved in any day in any netball centre around the world, around the country, but the efficiency of it, like, there's no messing around. It is regimented to within an inch of its life.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I sat next to Angus Houston, who was the head of the Defence Force, at a lunch a few years ago, and he said, looked at me with a straight face and said, netball women could run the army, and they probably should run the army. And it's so true. As Sherelle will agree, we, like, the women who run netball, you're scared of them from a very young age. You do exactly as you're told. You know, the netball competition, one of my friends, her little girl's netball competition starts on a Saturday at 11:43 a.m. Right? So we laugh and go, oh, my God. But it is also the sport that develops female leaders. You know, I've had a look at a lot of different sports and worked within a lot of different sports. And the thing that really strikes me about my sport is that I always assumed there was a place for women leadership. And then you look at other sports and you see that women are really fighting to get into the leadership positions, whether coaching, head of sport, admin, anything like that. But netball actually provides that all over the country at a grassroots level. So, you know, I think about the women who were the leaders in my community when I was a kid. And they weren't leaders by being the mayor or anything like that, but they ran the netball community and they got what they wanted. You don't say no to netball women, and I reckon there's a lot of people on those councils around Australia who would agree with that.
But that actually translates
into business and success later in life, because women learn through our sport very early how to step up and be leaders.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, Lizzie. And I mean, I'm really excited about this review that you're doing. I think that congratulations, and it's great that you're heading it up. One question possibly some people are asking is, are you going to listen when you do that canvassing and consultation? I do say that tongue in cheek slightly, Lizzie, because I mean, one of the big news stories in netball more recently has been the introduction of the 2-point shot for this season. That hopefully we get off the ground. And some would say that the consultation there was lacking in some ways. So is there part of that process that comes into looking at this as well, how we engage with the different stakeholders?
Yeah, look, and I think that was interesting, that 2-point shot. I look at it from a different point of view to you, and I think if I was a player or a coach, I'd be annoyed about the lack of consultation. But then when I look at that from the broadcast point of view, I'm actually really excited about what it will bring. I think you're right, though. I think the decision was probably made in a way that upset a lot of people, not just players and elite coaches, but, you know, our fans. So, you know, I think it's probably one of the things that we'll listen to about how we go about consulting with people and how that works. We don't have time to go fully into that decision and look at the granular sort of stuff, but it's a fair question. And I think the thing that I thought when they asked me to do this review was, oh my God, we've had so many reviews in the last 5 years. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel in terms of those reviews. We want to look at those reviews and say, okay, what was recommended and what didn't get actioned? What didn't the sport do? So we've got to look at that. And we actually have to take into account what people want. And I think, like all sports, there's an issue around personalities and clashes of personalities. And that's, you know, netball is not on its pat Malone there, and sport isn't immune to that. But we've got to look at how we make sure that clash of personalities actually works for the sport, and that will involve listening. And, you know, Shaz, you might agree with this. I think when I started off as a leader in our sport, I was a leader because I was the loudest and the bossiest. And it was always about my way or the highway. But by the time I finished, I actually became the leader who listened to my teammates, and I'm hoping that I can take those skills and those attributes into this review and just reassure people that my leadership style is inclusive. And, you know, but sometimes you have to make the hard calls that aren't popular. So while we will listen, it doesn't mean that we're going to agree with everything that we get told.
John Quinn would have been a 90210 fan. He's our fitness and high-performance guru on him here on The Breakfast Club. I wonder if he is a 90210 fan. Quinny, good morning.
Good morning. Actually, it's interesting. I still dress like them. I'm caught in that era.
So the sad thing is, Quinny, so am I. So am I. Now, they were very, very important people, very motivating forces through my teenage years and early 20s years, the 90210 crew. And that's the theme for our conversation today, those that have motivated and influenced your journey.
Yeah, well, look, it started off pretty on a sad note for me, really. A couple of days ago, I heard that one of my first big influences in my career, a guy called Peter Bowman. Peter Bowman pretty much set up the track and field and swimming at the AIS along with the great Don Talbot. And when I started, I was only a 26-year-old down in Tasmania, they sent me. And Peter Bowman was just a no-fuss, get-on-with-it type of administrator based up in Canberra. And he had a big influence on me. I remember his great saying used to be, don't worry about the bloody wood ducks, just do what you have to do. And, yesterday I turned up at the track and I wore my old AIS jacket as a bit of a tribute to Peter Bowman, who passed away on the weekend. So I've become a little bit nostalgic just thinking back on the old days under Peter Bowman and a big influence that he had on my career. And I think it's really important for whether you're a coach or an athlete or just your everyday life. I think it's really important to get mentors in your life. And Peter Bowman was certainly that for me.
So, John, tell us a little bit more about Peter as a boss of the AIS. Obviously, he was very influential on a lot of Australian athletes. What were some of the characteristics or some of the things that he did to kind of revolutionise the AIS and some of the Australian athletes with his thinking?
Yeah, well, the very fact that I was in Tasmania was part of his revolution. I think that they decentralised the AIS track and field, and we were spread out across the country. So I was down in Tasmania, and there was a setup here even in Sydney. And, you know, right across the place, well, Peter Bowman pretty much drove that. But I just think it was his vision of getting the sport up. He wouldn't take it that it wasn't the most important sport. His other great thing was it was the banner sport. And, you know, just used to instill that in everybody, that that's you just had to drive that through. And for me, you know, when I think of Peter Bowman, I just think of no fuss and get on with it. And as a young bloke, that really impacted on me. And I'd like to think that I still carry that type of mantra. And I keep an eye out for the wood ducks to this day. And I just get on with the job, whatever has to happen. And it was, it really helped, actually, when I come up to Sydney to get the Giants going. You know, we had to just carry that through and get on with the job. And, so missing Pete today and condolences to his family.
John, we spoke to Mick Malthouse a little bit earlier and he spoke about, you know, the amazing people that he had around him at different times in his career and, you know, the bits and pieces he took for them, but the importance of just being yourself in whatever role you're holding to. And although you've had those great influences, I'm sure that that's something that you've done in your career too and good advice for others.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I actually listened to the interview that you had with Mick. He's a great man. I've only met him briefly, but I think I'd get on quite well with Mick. I loved his comment about Hafey, you know, kick 35 because they're not going to kick 36. So I think that Hafey definitely had an influence on Kevin Sheedy as well because Sheedy's that type of mentality, you know, enthusiasm and positivity, and there's no doubt that Sheedy's had that with me. But whilst it's good to have mentors, you know, I talk about Peter Bowman, now talking about Kevin Sheedy, you've got to develop your own system and you've got to know, well, what is it that you stand for? What do you believe in? And, you know, I guess it comes down to understand the why. The really sad thing is I reckon a lot of coaches get out there for their ego and how this is going to make them look. And what it should be, for me anyway, is how do you get the most out of the athletes that you're working with, whether they be an athlete on the track or an athlete on the court or an athlete on the field? You know, how do you get the most out of them? And I'd like to think that I judge my own success as a coach, not by the stars that I've worked with, but pretty much by the people that no one will have ever heard of, the ones that have improved the most under your coaching. They mightn't have achieved great things on the world stage, but in terms of their own personal development and growth, they have. And I think you've just got to understand your why.
Yeah, that is the key.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting. And John, from when you're training athletes and we talk about mentors, how much of it is you getting them to not necessarily visualise, but have people that they can turn to emulate or to be like, versus actually making sure you have that inner motivation to improve yourself, and that it's actually your own motivation as opposed to someone else's, if that makes sense?
Yeah, encourage your athletes to keep looking for better ways to do things, and hopefully you become that for your athlete. I mean, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, it's even politically correct, but in a way you fall in love with your athletes, and that's just the way it is. You know, they become everything for you, but I think you've got to drive them and show the passion. You've almost got to become a zealot. And again, for me, going back, and someone that I don't think you guys would have ever heard of, but way back in the 70s, there was a guy that had this vision to set up little athletics in New South Wales, but spread it nationwide. And his name was Peter Shinnick, and Peter's no longer with us either, but Peter Shinnick had a big influence on me. He was like a zealot, and we were pushing the mantra of athletics for kids and to get that out there. And that grew to over 100,000 members across the country. And I think having that vision and drive to get that through, that's really important. So that's another side of that whole point of growing yourself.
Jackson McRae is one of the stars of the Western Bulldogs midfield, and he's been good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Jackson, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Great to have you on the program. Where was the wash-up from the game on Sunday against the Blues? Things were going so well, Jackson. Three in a row, looking really positive. What was the summary from the review with Luke Beveridge and co?
Probably a few things. I think, obviously, the way we started the game, they definitely got a jump on us. And I think it just shows how even the competition is. And just you have to be on your game from the very start. Or if you give teams a look, and it's pretty hard to get back into the game. And it felt like we was just an arm wrestle all game, trying to, you know, bring it back from that four-goal start that they had. And after that, then in the last quarter, they really put the foot down. So a lot of areas that we probably let ourselves down in, and hopefully we can... It's a quick turnaround, so hopefully we can bring that Friday night against Essendon.
I must admit, the last quarter did surprise me. I was covering the game, and I was going through the numbers and just watching that third quarter unfold, and you had a lot of uncontested possession, and I thought that the Blues might have been tiring a bit, and you might have been able to get a hold of them in the last quarter. What was the message at three-quarter time from Bevo?
It was a one of a positive one, because especially in the second and third quarters, I felt personally we were on top, but we probably just weren't converting goals and our chances. And it felt like there was a lot of those plays where we probably should have kicked a goal and then they'd go and kick it. Carlton was a bit deflating, but full credit to Carlton as well. The way they played that last quarter, they played some pretty exciting football as well. And it was very disappointing to see it blow out like that.
I guess it shows, Jackson, also about in those shortened games, there's two things. Firstly, just taking your opportunities that you alluded to. You had plenty of them through that middle phase of the match to get yourself almost in that position where Carlton would start to panic, but you just couldn't quite get close enough with the chances that you missed.
Yeah, I think scoreboard pressure and momentum is a big thing, and that's probably something touched on that we gave them at the start of the game, but we never really got ourselves into a position to get back in our favour. So, yeah, it's something obviously that's really important is converting goals and not just getting the chances. So, yeah, it's something we'll work on in training and hopefully bring Friday night.
I'm rapt that we're speaking to you because I love watching you play footy, and I'm interested in your thoughts on yourself personally, how the shortened games affect you as a footballer, because you're someone that is such a great athlete and accumulates a lot of the footy, and often you get a lot of your possessions in the second halves of quarters as fatigue starts to set in. So when you're playing the shortened games, how does that affect you as a footballer, not being able to grind your opposition into the dirt?
I think for, you know, players like me who probably aren't the best, most powerful athletes, but, a bit, you know, like similar to an Andrew Gaff kind of player or something like that.
Yep.
I think it's a bit overstated how the shorter quarters affect my kind of player, because, you know, when you play a game of footy, you're pretty cooked whether it's 2 minutes in or 20 minutes in. So that's how I view it, really. It's just continue to play my natural game. But I think one thing you guys touched on that it does really it shows off is if you have a bad 5 minutes or you're not 100% on your game for the start of the game or the whole quarter, it can really affect how you play individually and the team. So that's probably something that I think the whole competition is starting to adapt to, is if you have a poor 5 minutes, it can really probably cost you the game.
Yeah. So how does it affect you in regards to going to the bench and your rotations? There was one quarter, I think it may have been the third quarter, where you were caught on the bench for quite a while because the play was on the other side of the field. But then I've noticed other times where you're pretty much out there for the entire quarter. So how has the rotations affected your game?
Yeah, it's been pretty similar. We've obviously changed it a little bit with obviously the shorter quarters, making sure you probably only go to the bench once a quarter. And obviously, especially the last few weeks, we've had a few injuries in games as well. And that's the other thing with the shorter quarters and also the more time in between goals, is when you're losing an injury, it's probably not as a bigger disadvantage to your side, which is obviously, I think it's a good thing when nothing worse than if you get an injury and then you're playing catch up the whole game. So, yeah, for me, it's been just trying to be ready each quarter because, as I said, you're only out there for 15 minutes or so, so you can't really catch yourself, you know, dawdling around.
We had the coach, Luke Beveridge, on the program last week. Jackson, we're talking about Lockie Hunter, who was back into the team on the weekend, played a really good game too, had 27 disposals and was really consistent from start to finish. And he was talking about how what had happened to him has altered him as a player. Have you seen those changes as a teammate in Lockie in the last couple of months?
Yeah, he's always been a very vocal teammate. And I think especially the opportunity to have, you know, obviously not a wanted opportunity, but to have a few weeks off. But it's probably given him a look into areas that he can improve as well, as a player as well, in different areas such as going inside, being a bit more physical and not just being a, you know, outside player that he's been, you know, for the last few years.
And tell me, I didn't know Latham was a name, but you've got one of those in your team, Latham Vandermeer, who's come along this year. And, geez, he's an impressive footballer. He seems to be a natural footballer. He looks like a pretty good athlete too, but he seems to get the game pretty well. What have you made of his impact on the Dogs so far?
Yeah, when he first came to the club, he was more of a half-back, kind of a bit of like a JJ running half-back player. And he's obviously fitted into, wing, half-forward. He's played multiple roles. He's only played a handful of games. And the game's hard enough as it is, but it can be quite challenging if you're shifting the magnets around as a young player. So he's adapted extremely well. Full credit to him on the weekend. He, as I touched on, he was probably one of those players that probably could have kicked four or five goals. But it is bloody hard to get in those spots as a forward, and he seems to pop up in the right spots and giving himself those opportunities.
Port Adelaide, did you know, top of the AFL ladder. They are going magnificently. Had a little bit of a hiccup against the Brisbane Lions, but came back and went whooshka to the Giants and got back on the horse. And Dan Houston's a big part of that team at the Power. He's been good enough to join us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you on the program, particularly when you're top of the table, which we think is fantastic. We've been watching Port Adelaide with great interest this year. We quite like Kenny Hinkley, and we quite like the list you've got there. And you're starting to put it all together, Dan. Are you feeling something building there at the Power?
Yeah, definitely. I think, at the start of the year, we played some really good footy and played some good footy in a hub as well. Again, probably not the quality of the opposition, which... we have been in the last few weeks, but we certainly were gaining a bit of momentum, and then we were really good at putting it together against GWS, and probably just missed the mark a bit against Brisbane. But we're feeling, definitely we've got a great balance of youth and experience in our team, and Kenny's coaching us really well this year, which has also helped.
How disappointed was the group with that performance against Brisbane? Because it was a good chance to measure yourself against a really good team on their home deck. And we know the hub life's different for a lot of people, but it was their home deck at the Gabba that day. And you just didn't quite get up to speed for that game. How disappointed was the group?
Yeah, very disappointed. I mean, we were really non-competitive for most of the night. Our pressure around the ball was horrible. We were out-muscled, out-played. And as you said before, it was a great opportunity to really show, how far we have come and how good of a team we were. And we really butchered the opportunity. And it was all stuff that we could have controlled. And we just really didn't rock up on the night. And we thought that GWS was a great opportunity just to really, you know, get back on the horse, like you said, and show everyone, you know, how good we are and respond to the Brisbane Lions game, which was really poor on our behalf.
I must confess, Dan, I love seeing Kenny in the rooms after that win, getting in the middle of the circle and being genuinely excited. And I know it was a special day for him personally, becoming an AFL Life member, but it just felt that was a significant win for the club, particularly the way you did it.
Yeah, definitely. I think we had to fly in and fly out on that day as well, which is another hurdle that we've sort of overcome a bit, which is pretty tough. You wake up at 4:30 and you sort of have to waste a bit of time before the game, which normally you wouldn't have to do. You'd be at home, you know, watching TV or carrying on with what you usually do. So that was a little bit different. Then obviously, yeah, Kenny, Life membership, everyone was stoked for him. And usually he's not too keen on the limelight, but it was good to have him in the middle of the circle. I mean, boys were pretty careful about how much Gatorade they were going to pour on him. But they might not get a spot next week if they poured too much, but it was, it was good to have him in the middle and celebrate with us.
Has it been difficult? I mean, I think a lot of people don't realise that you guys are flying home, preparing back in Adelaide, and then going back to play these games in Queensland, getting up at 4:30, that sort of thing, as you touched on. How difficult has it been?
Yeah, well, it probably sounded pretty good flying fly out on the day. You know, you're back in your home state, but it probably was a little bit harder than what I thought it was going to be. It's more so, you know, the flight home and all the stuff after the game, where usually you'd just be zipping straight home, but you've actually got to wait around and do a lot of waiting after a game. And if you do lose a game, it can be pretty hard, I would imagine, because you're always around the coaches, you're always around the players, and the mood just wouldn't be the same for those 4 hours of travelling or whatever you have to do. But then saying that, if you win, it's probably a little bit better, but still the travelling is just, it just takes a bit out of you on the way home. And knowing that you have to do it the next week is just something that you just got to make sure you just, you know, you get your head around it early on in the week and take it day by day so that you're not stressing about it.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Now, I'm talking on behalf of a number of people that have you in fantasy teams because... You made the move from a running defender and you played some midfield minutes last year and you really sort of consolidated yourself in the team and you went from, you know, right up the ranks as a footballer. This year, kind of a little bit more back towards halfback, a bit more midfield time last week. How much are you enjoying that extra responsibility of getting in where the action is?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I probably, towards the end of last year, got in the middle a bit more and then trained as a midfielder in the pre-season. And then played a bit more in the back line towards the start of the year. Obviously, Ollie was back this year where he wasn't last year. So that sort of... Yeah. They pushed him straight into the midfield and I was happy to play half-back for a bit. And then, obviously, Tom Rockliffe going out on the weekend. Kenny was able to put me back in the midfield, which was good. And I'll obviously play that role throughout the year. You know, going to halfback or going back into the midfield, whatever suits. I've had a few of my mates who also have me in fantasy just spraying me every week because I don't know where I'm playing.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.